welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us, Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper is still recovering from a severe back injury, and we do hope to have him back very soon. When people speak of Rebecca Miller, they usually note that she's the daughter of a great playwright and the wife of a great actor. Her father was Arthur Miller, the author of Death of a Salesman and The Crucible. Her husband is three-time Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis. But Rebecca Miller has made a name for herself as a writer and a filmmaker. She has directed four movies and published three novels. Her latest book, Jacob's Folly, is about an 18th century French actor and a 21st century Orthodox Jewish woman, both conflicted about their identities, whose paths cross under fantastic circumstances. It has been praised as a charming exploration of the competing demands of individual freedom and communal responsibility. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Miller. He began by asking her how writing a novel differs from writing a screenplay.
Writing a screenplay is really a kind of blueprint. It's, in a way, it's the bones without the flesh, and it can't be too fleshed out because you're waiting for the actors to fill it up with life, in a way. So you have to kind of almost restrain yourself. In a novel or a piece of fiction, you're filling it up with the sensory writing where you describe smell and taste and what things exactly look like and what emotions feel like and trying to find visual ways of explaining an emotion. In a way, a screenplay is the opposite of that. It's really, it's a kind of vessel, and yet it has to have a motion forward. A screenplay has to somehow move forward in ways that a novel doesn't have to quite the same way.
Well, you said that in the novel you can go deep vertically, but in film you move laterally. What does that mean?
Well, digression is something that in a novel can be very rewarding. For example, just for a long time explaining what someone is thinking, or allowing yourself to meander or free associate down a kind of wormhole can actually be very rewarding for a reader because they're getting more information about a character that they're curious about. Whereas in a film, if a film kind of stops moving, and I don't necessarily mean just an action film because I don't make action films, but even a kind of mystery of character, which is usually what I do, you still have to kind of have every scene be a kind of chess move, that you're always moving forward, you're always moving forward. So in that sense, I mean that that's a kind of lateral motion forward versus this kind of more depth, plumbing the depths. One of the reasons I use voiceover quite frequently, or not in every film, but in The Private Lives of Pippa Lee I did, and in Personal Velocity I did, is to kind of give another layer of depth over the action so that you can kind of just swim in it while you're watching the film and take in as much or as little as you want to. You don't need to listen to every single moment of the voiceover, but it's an overlay. Sometimes that's where a lot of the humor in the film is, the irony. It gives you extra information and allows me to move very fast time-wise without having to have scenes that I don't necessarily want to have. It's a kind of shorthand. But definitely you can sort of see why my roots are in writing because of that.
Well, your work up to this point has been realistic. Your novels and movies deal with flesh and blood characters in entirely plausible situations. But your new novel, Jacob's Folly, lays out a fantastic premise. Jacob is an 18th century Jewish peddler in Paris who dies and then reappears in the 21st century, reincarnated as a telepathic fly. You were taking a risk here, weren't you?
Yes. But it was a risk that seemed quite logical in certain ways. I did the math, if you know what I mean, a kind of writerly math, and ended up with this structure and this form. Because what happened was, in the very beginning, I had two very earthly characters, which is I had Masha and Leslie Sensatimore, who I knew was a very good man who was a volunteer fireman, a kind of heroic figure. And I thought in the beginning, well, Masha is somehow going to destroy him. I didn't yet know how. I just had this idea that she was somehow going to destroy this other character. I didn't yet know that she was Jewish. I then happened to be rowing in a lake in Brooklyn in a flock of Hasidic Jews. And I had always been very interested, especially women Hasidic Jews, and how the logic of that life worked, especially in a place like New York, where they differ so mightily from the culture around them. And I was fascinated by the kind of hermetic nature of their culture and how it persisted and so, you know, and so on. And I felt very foreign from it. But I suddenly thought, what if Masha is one of those people? And I ended up finally deciding they weren't Hasidic, but ultra-Orthodox. There isn't that much difference. There are differences, but in terms of custom, they're basically the same. So, but there's so much Yiddish spoken that I didn't think I could penetrate that culture so easily. Anyway, once I realized that she was Jewish, I started doing a lot of research, and I found that there's reincarnation in Judaism. It's called Gilgul, and it's the reincarnation of Jewish souls. And sometimes they can be reincarnated as creatures. And then I started reading Isaac Bashevis Singer, who uses quite a lot, the idea of little sprites or little spiders, animals that speak to people that are reincarnated or in animals or cats. And I realized that it was actually a very big part of Jewish folklore, which I then immersed myself in. So in a way, this book is very much in the tradition of Jewish folklore.
We're speaking with Rebecca Miller, whose latest novel is Jacob's Folly. Identity is a key theme in the novel. Well, it's a key theme in all your work, I think. Every movie you've made and every book you've written is about someone, a woman usually, who's trying to find herself. But the identity here is ethnic, Jewish. Jacob is a Jew living in a time when Jews are ghettoized, restricted. He encounters a strange aristocrat who wants to play the role of Pygmalion. Without giving too much away, what happens then?
Well, Jacob becomes the valet of this man, who's a very rich count of the aristocracy, who takes him on as a kind of challenge and seeks to turn him into not a Jew, but a man. And this is partly was a big debate in France and became much bigger as time went on into the 19th century of, is a Jew inherently Jewish, or is it really just custom that they wear like a cloak? How inherent is Jewishness? Because the French were particularly interested in a way taking away that the quality of being almost a nation apart that the Jews had in their midst, and to just make them part of larger French society, which actually led to quite a lot of anti-Semitism later on, which is connected to things that happened later.
Well, because during Nazi Germany, it didn't matter if you were a Jew who had been there for generations, you weren't German. They didn't consider you German, even though you consider yourself German. You were a patriotic German. And so the same thing against the French and these other countries.
Well, it was very much the same in France. And it was interesting because I also, because the novel goes through so much time, there's a period where we kind of alight in the 1940s France. And there's a character, Max, who's Jacob's great-great-grandchild, who is living in Nazi Germany and believes himself, because he's from a very old Jewish family in France, to be sort of immune. And really, he thinks that it's these recent immigrants who are wearing their caftans and their long beards and look so extremely Jewish that are going to be persecuted, and that he, as somebody who's very well educated and looks like a Frenchman, will not. And he realizes soon that that's not the case.
Was that old joke, if you can call it one, that if you ever forget you're a Jew, don't worry, somebody will remind you.
Right.
You know, and not in a pleasant way, obviously. Where did you get the idea for the Count? Because he was a bizarre character. I mean, he's rather something of a pervert.
Well, it's interesting because I was making The Private Lives of Pippa Lee. We were living in Connecticut, and I was reading, for some reason, I felt compelled to read a book called At Home with the Marquis de Sade, which was actually written by a friend of mine. And for some reason, it was strangely comforting to read about this world that was so different from what I was doing at that moment. But I have a way of, you know, the unconscious has funny ways of working, and that I think that I was already sort of simmering my next project. So I had this idea at first that Jacob maybe would become the valet of the Marquis de Sade. And then I thought, no, of course not, because the Marquis de Sade will take over everything and it'll be about the Marquis de Sade. So then I thought, well, maybe he could be the valet of a neighbor of the Marquis de Sade. So somebody who might have known him, who traveled in the same circles, who had some of the same predilections, but didn't have this fantastic literary aspirations and also enormous talent, and was also a sort of humbler example of that type of life. And so the Count came into being, and I ended up really loving the character of the Count, but that's really where he came from.
And the title, Jacob's Folly, refers to something that not doesn't refer to Jacob necessarily himself, but something on the Count's property.
Yes, a folly, an architectural folly.
Exactly, which has a lot of symbolic significance. At least I saw it that way.
Yes.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write this novel? Because you're a very busy woman.
Well, it took me 5 years, and I just spent 5 years just writing the novel. I mean, I didn't know how long it was going to take me at first, but the amount of reading that I had to do, as well as writing, I was always writing and then, you know, for 6 months, and then reading and then writing and then reading. I wrote as much as I knew, and then I would stop and start reading again. And I had a great research assistant without whom I don't think I could have done it in that amount of time.
Okay, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist and filmmaker Rebecca Miller. I'm Aaron Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist and filmmaker Rebecca Miller, whose latest book, Jacob's Folly, is a fantasy about an 18th century French actor who is reincarnated into the 21st century as a telepathic fly. Rebecca, in his book, The Wicked Son, David Mamet attacks Jews who reject their identity or criticize their own people or the state of Israel. These self-hating Jews, or as he calls them, wicked sons, are as bad as anti-Semites. Is Jacob one of those wicked sons that would send Mamet into a frenzy?
Well, he may start the book as that. I don't think he ends the book as that. I think the power of his own of who he is and his own culture overwhelms him finally, I think. But that's interesting. I didn't know about that book.
It's a screed, really. It's, you know that Mamet's now become this big right-wing crazy.
What? Really?
Yes, he has. Absolutely.
I had no idea.
Yes, he has. And he's now become, as Woody Allen once said about one of his characters, Jewish with a vengeance.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually didn't know he was Jewish. It's terrible.
Oh, wow. Okay.
How far behind I am.
All right. But no, but the whole point, again, of Jewish identity, to go back there for a moment, because that is a big part of the novel.
Yeah.
Masha. Yes. You mentioned Masha.
Yes.
Masha Edelman?
Edelman.
She, as you said, belongs to an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family.
Yeah.
As part of your research for the novel, you spent time with an Orthodox Jewish family. What was that like?
Well, it was amazing in the sense that, in the true sense of being so surprised by what I found, because I didn't know what to expect, really. I really didn't know what to expect. And what I found was, first of all, a culture where the women were very powerful and very, most of them worked, the women that I met. The husbands seemed to be very present in the children's lives. There was enormous division of the day into ritual moments. There were brachas, blessings, specific to every moment of eating and type of eating, etc., the preparation of food and the ways in which the husband was continually going to prayer. But there was a real, I have to say, a real beauty to the life that I found, which I really didn't see at all before I went in there and started researching. I felt just very alienated from it and didn't understand why the women in particular would be covering their heads and be in the hottest day of summer in New York City wearing long sleeves and thick stockings. And I thought, you know what, I really didn't understand how for them there is the real beauty of living in that way. Not that I could imagine myself going and living in that way at this point in my life, but I definitely would say that I had a real about face in terms of how I saw that life.
I don't want to disparage that lifestyle at all, but in your conversations with the women in the community, is it a choice that they've made, or is it simply an outgrowth of their upbringing?
Well, you know, I have to say that I was specifically in a particular family where the woman, the matriarch of the family, the woman, her father had not been ultra-Orthodox, had become more of a conservative Jew and an ultra-Orthodox Jew later in his life, and had in a way lived through the 60s and so on, and then made this choice and raised his children in a more conservative way. So she had been raised within that way of life, but, and I feel like she thought it was a choice, but, you know, I mean, I don't know how much any of us can say we're really choosing to live the way we are and how much we're really conditioned, even those of us who are liberal style people. You know, I think that it's that there were people in their community that left, and they were regarded with a certain amount of sadness, like as if that they just had a sad life, that it was sad that they had left because that they wouldn't get to partake in this wonderful life. And there are definitely things that I found to be really difficult, which, for example, if you don't fit into that life, there is no way of fitting in. For example, they did think of being gay as an illness, and that was something that would be very hard to disabuse them all. Although within our conversation at the dinner table, there was disagreement. The mother thought more, actually, no, it may be a point that it isn't. But that's a very, there are certain things that are just really hard whenever you're living within a very codified existence. But I can see the comfort of it. I guess just because I can see other people's points of view quite easily. I saw their point of view, and I, you know, the darker elements of it, I didn't really touch on so much in the book because it wasn't really pertinent to my story.
Yes, your portrayal of the Orthodox family is very sympathetic, I felt. And it would be very easy to make fun of them or to mock them, but you didn't do that. You treated them as, this isn't such a bad family. It's pretty nice.
Yeah.
In other words, why is Masha leaving them? Is that
well,
that bad?
I think, you know, what Masha is leaving them, in a way, it's a similar thing when you say, you know, if you're gay, then there perhaps isn't a place for you. If you're somebody who needs to, you know, as a performer, somebody who has, you know, singing in front of, for women to sing in front of men who they're not related to is not allowed. And they can't work on the Sabbath. And that, if you're really, if you're really going to live that life fully, then you cannot become an actress or a singer, because you can't have both. And I think finally, if you're an artist deep in your marrow, well, then that's what you are.
We're speaking with Becca Miller, whose latest book is Jacob's Folly. You mentioned acting, and yes, acting is another big part of this novel, because Jacob becomes an actor. He turns from peddling to acting, which is another form of peddling. And Masha wants to be an actress. She wants to be a Sister Carrie-like figure. She wants to be an actress. It's funny because I was reading recently this story by Kurt Vonnegut, Who Am I This Time? It's about this small local amateur group of actors, and there's this shy woman who meets this other shy man, but once he actually assumes the character, he really lights up. He becomes this incredibly passionate, romantic figure. And obviously they fall in love, because the problem is she has to keep him acting. She has to keep him in this row, in these different rows. So he has to be Faust one night and he has to be Romeo the other night. And he really gets into the row very seriously. So how, you know, since you're a director, and yes, you're also married to an actor, the great Daniel Day-Lewis, who is famous for assuming his roles. I wonder how it was living with Abraham Lincoln for a year. What have you learned about acting that you then informed this novel?
Well, I did want to approach almost the metaphysical elements of acting with this, to start to begin to describe the... When it's done at a very high level, the kind of forgetting of the self, the going into a kind of zone, which is, I would say, almost a spiritual zone, which I think acting is still now often considered to be a rather shallow occupation. And I think it can be, just like anything can be done in different ways. But I think at its highest level, there's something really special about it, and really, to me, almost awe-inspiring about it. And I wanted to, and I do talk about that in particular with Masha, who I think is in a way working at a deeper level than Jacob was before her. And really, it's hard for me to, in a way, you have to read the book, because I can't go back and describe.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
You know, acting is certainly in your background, because your father, Arthur Miller,
yes,
was, you know, one of America's great playwrights, the man who wrote Death of a Salesman, The Crucible. And recently, I don't know if you got a chance to see Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, of course.
Death of a Salesman.
I did.
With directed by Mike Nichols, who's a director you've worked with before.
Yeah.
It's a timeless play, because it doesn't matter how much time has passed.
No.
And of course, his performance was great. Mm. What is it about that play that just keeps it going all the time?
I think it's just so touching. You know, you just... Weirdly, you walk out of that play feeling you've watched a very realistic play, whereas in fact, you've watched a piece of poetry unfold on the stage. And that's because the emotion is so gripping. And you're watching somebody fall apart in that way in front of you in real life. It's, you know, it's almost unbearable to remember Phil doing it because of what happened afterwards. But it's hard to say. I think in a way, all pieces of art that work have a mysterious element that no artist can go back and say, oh yeah, I added three tablespoons of salt and, you know, a dash of parsley. It, in the end, the recipe goes away once you finish.
Well, thank you for coming. We've been speaking with Rebecca Miller.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. You can see his reviews and blog on the Huffington Post. He also reviews books for the Miami Herald and interviews authors for Topical Currents, which is what you're listening to on 91.3 WLRN. Stay with us. Food and Dining is next.
We're funded by listeners like you and by the Westin Diplomat Resort and Spa, located beachfront in Hollywood, offering ocean view rooms, heavenly spa, poolside cabanas, kids club, golf, tennis, and water sports. Information at diplomatresort.com.
We're funded by listeners like you and by TMS Treatment Centers of America, offering a non-invasive treatment for depression without the use of medications, anesthesia, or sedation. Information on the center is available at tmscenterofamerica.com.
This week at Ocinema Miami Shores, Ida is a moving drama about a young nun in 1960s Poland who, on the verge of taking her vows, makes a shocking discovery about her past. The New York Times called it one of the finest European films in recent memory. Details at o-cinema.org.
Family visits may be easier, and there may be more money traveling between the U.S. and Cuba, so what's next? Tomorrow on the Florida Roundup, NPR Morning Edition host David Green joins us after spending a week in Cuba, talking with government officials, entrepreneurs, and shopkeepers. Did the state fudge data over child abuse deaths? A Miami-Dade grand jury accuses the state child welfare agency of undercounting child abuse and neglect deaths, and the cost to taxpayers of the rush to open charter schools, only to then have them close. The Florida Roundup, tomorrow at noon.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents for the few of you who are not listening to or watching the World Cup and U.S. playing Germany. It's good to have you with us. Joseph Cooper is recovering from a severe back injury, and he appreciates your warm wishes. So how are your skills at impressing and amazing your guests at the dinner table? Joining us now is chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend Linda Gassenheimer. Welcome, Linda. I could definitely use some help here.
Could you?
I could.
Nice to be with you, Bonnie.
Likewise.
Okay, so Bonnie, voodoo shrimp served in a mysterious cloud.
Voodoo shrimp?
Shrimp in a mysterious cloud.
Hmm.
Or bass in a bag. I mean, that's literally a brown paper bag. A couple of surprises served at Barton G, the restaurant. His food creates fun and theater. And, you know, I always thought that these types of dishes were just too difficult to make at home. But Barton G says, not true. He has a new book out that's helping us, and it's called The Big Dish, Recipes to Dazzle and Amaze. And he's here to help us amaze our guests at home, and yours too, Bonnie.
Great.
Welcome, Barton G.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Welcome. Hi. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for Barton G? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Or you can email us.
You can email radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Right. The phones are open now. Of course, also with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. He gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes column, and you can also read Fred's wine column. It's in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, first, I want to say we miss you, Joe. We hope you'll be back soon. And second, I'm going to talk about some dazzling wine cocktails.
Aha. Uh-huh. Mm. Okay. Barton G., congratulations on the big dish.
Thank you.
And also, you're calling in from L.A. You've opened a restaurant there?
We just opened a week ago.
All right. Congratulations back on that. Okay. So you have several restaurants now. You have an amazing event planning company. Why are you writing a book? You had nothing else to do?
No. Actually, that was the best project I think I've ever worked on in my total career. I had no ideas in mind of what I had to do. It was just a blank canvas, and we just kept creating for over a year. And I met up with Rizzoli, who looked at the book and said, it's adorable, and it's definitely different than anything else that would be on a bookshelf, and it would jump out, and they felt that this was a good and a good alternative to the serious cookbook.
Well, it's definitely an alternative, and the pictures are amazing. You have step-by-step instructions, which we need, because I mentioned at the beginning, your creations always seem beyond our reach at home, so help us out. Can you give us some examples of dishes that we can make that's going to wow our guests?
Well, there's quite a few dishes. If you looked at our recipes, I was very emphatic of making them simple, easy, and non-intimidating.
Bonnie's rolling her eyes. She's looking at some of these.
Because I looked through the book, and easy does not come to mind when I look through the book.
Give us an example.
Okay, well, one of the examples is if you take the lobster Pop-Tarts, which we're very well known for, it's something that can be done at home. It's lobster, it's Gruyere cheese, and phyllo pastry.
So first you have to cook the lobster.
Oh, you want to go there? Yeah. The lobster gets cooked first.
Yeah.
Then it gets mixed within, there's four different spices. So you've got you've got pepper, and you've got a little bit of coriander mixed into it. And it gets assembled and cooked in a pot. Then it gets laid out on a table with phyllo pastry. You make strips, and you put the stuffing in the phyllo, roll it up like a Pop-Tart, fold the edges, and you've got this square oblong object, which put it in the oven, heat it up, and it's amazing.
Well, you know, what I think is wonderful about your book is it you've got all the play on childhood favorites like Pop-Tarts.
Well, and you know what? That's really what I do. I mean, about 20 years ago, when I started, everyone looked at me that I was crazy. But it was for children, and it's really not for children. It's the child in the adult. And that's who really, it warms them, it's familiar to them, and they have a ball with it.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of a childhood favorite, like your s'mores. But you make the, I'm laughing because I'm just looking at it. You make a marshmallow in an angel food cake pan. So it's enormous.
Right. We did that, and then we put chocolate ganache in the middle. And then you had all of your marshmallows to dip and graham crackers. But in the book, you'll see a new take on s'mores, and it's a pizza. It comes in a pizza box. You open it up, and it looks exactly like a savory pizza, but it's not. It's
That's your marshmallow pizza.
Yes.
I don't know how we got on desserts right away.
I don't know.
Linda, I wonder how we got on desserts right away.
But with chocolate, indeed.
Yeah, well, let me also say that I think what's really interesting and taking great ideas from it is that you go around to antique shops and things, and you find unusual ways, pieces to serve. I can't even call them dishes, to serve the food in. For example, I'm thinking of your the antique box, the treasure box. Tell us about that.
Well, and that's a jewelry box that was in somebody's home, and that it was just in the to-go box. And I saw it and thought, wow, wouldn't this be a beautiful way in which to serve a luncheon? And everything is all minis, and that they're delicate. So it's more of a takeoff of a tea sandwich.
Well, I'm looking at that. And you call it a treasure chest, and then it's served on a tray. Just to explain what the picture looks like, it's served on a tray, and you've got gold coins, gold chocolate coins, and then the sand is graham crackers.
I'm sorry. I was talking about a different one.
Oh.
But, okay, the chocolate treasure is a chocolate indulgence. So it's a huge brownie. Half-baked with homemade vanilla ice cream and brownie ice cream. And it sits in a treasure chest because once you take a bite out of it, it's like a treasure. You never, ever want to forget the taste. And there's a shovel to give the effect of this treasure chest was found at the bottom of the sea. And the shovel, funny enough, people use to eat the dessert.
A regular shovel?
It's a regular outdoor shovel.
Oh, my God.
So it's serving dessert on a shovel. I remember when you first opened your restaurant, Barton G. The Restaurant, and you ordered swordfish, and it was served on a sword.
That's it. Absolutely.
Some other ideas I thought, just serving ice, and you'll have to forgive me, but I was thinking that you could take the serving ideas and go buy the brownies to put in it. But I'm thinking that you're thinking of serving your desserts in a small dim sum style, like the steaming boxes.
Right.
And serve things that way. Tell us about that.
Well, everything I do is pretty much slanted or backwards. So when I see sushi, I'm not a sushi eater, but it's architecturally beautiful when you actually see them displayed in those little steamers. So what we did is we did a play on it, and we reversed it. Instead of it being sushi, it's sort of like little pedophores. And you go to the Chinese store or even the supermarket, and they all have those little steamer baskets. And it's just a clever way in which to serve something that's unexpected.
Right, and back to savory things. We're not only going to desserts. I was looking at the picture. I think this is another great idea to make a shepherd's pie, but you're serving it individual ones in little parfait glasses.
Right, old-fashioned parfait glasses. And I also, in the same, sort of the same family as we do meatball parfaits, and it's the same type of glass.
So bringing that to the table just sounds like it would be so much fun. It makes dinners fun rather than just stuffy.
Correct.
Right.
And that's my whole, that's the key to everything that I do, is if it's been done before, I don't want to see it. And I want people to always remember the dinner party that they were at. So if you look at my book and take one or two of those items, and you can reinterpret them, that's not the problem. The book was for inspiration, that it gets you thinking of something that you might have in your home.
Well, talk about
it. You can do this because you're Barton G. If somebody like me tries to do something really off the wall like that, how are people going to react?
I think they would react quite well. I think that they would always remember, Fred, your dinner party that you threw, and the little touch of the appetizer was a mini shepherd pie in different colors. They would remember that, and they would look at you like you're crazy, but they'd love it.
But that's a good thing. Yeah, now I'm inspired. I'll give that a try.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like your tartare puzzle. That's very cool. That's a great idea.
Explain what it is.
It's tartare. In this case, it's steak tartare, but it's in the shape of puzzle pieces, jigsaw puzzle pieces. So, I mean, it's really beautiful. It's a gorgeous way to serve it.
And it's really easy. It's really, really easy. And you take a puzzle piece, put it on your copier machine, and blow it up by 200%, and there's your pattern. How you actually cut out the puzzle. And then it's a traditional steak tartare on top. But if you do the different shapes of the puzzles, I did a whole board of it. I created a scene. You don't have to.
Okay.
It's interesting when you go to serve it, people take a piece out of the puzzle.
Well, right. And on the I was interested that on the cover of the book you put sliders, little sliders. But instead of the slider roll, you have biscuits.
Exactly. I changed everything over to biscuits and all different flavors. So rather than how everybody serves sliders on a bun, these biscuits are divine because it adds to the flavor of the, some of those are foie gras, there's a bunch of different ones, or even just a plain slider. It gives it so much more spunk. And just a plain bun. And they look pretty.
Well, on that note, we're just going to take a short break here. And we're talking with Barton G. about his book, The Big Dish. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we've been talking with Barton G. He's an event planner extraordinaire. And he always delights with his whimsical and fun dishes. His book is The Big Dish, Recipes to Dazzle and Amaze. And he's been giving us recipe tips on how to amaze our guests at home. And I think, Bonnie, you think maybe you could do some of this.
I think
And Fred thought he could, too.
Bonnie,
let's get
Fred
together.
Fred and I are in the same boat. I know.
Well, at the moment, it's dinner in minutes time. And today's dinner in minutes is Korean grilled chicken with steamed noodles. Chicken thighs are coated with a garlicky soy sauce glaze. You can grill them outside, or if it's too hot, you can grill them on a stovetop grill. I marinate the chicken in some soy sauce, some vinegar, garlic, sesame oil, some other ingredients for about 5 minutes. Then I remove the chicken, but I save the marinade. And so you cook the chicken, and then I cook the marinade for a few minutes, and then I glaze the chicken with it. It's so simple and easy. Meanwhile, you can make some steamed Chinese noodles. You boil the noodles, and I added some broccoli florets and some shredded carrots. You'd no prep here. They're already ready for you in the supermarket. The complete recipe and a photo can be found at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, it's cocktails today?
Absolutely. I guess if the social media have it right, and I suppose they do, restaurants and private hosts around the country are dazzling their guests with exotic new cocktails these days. Cocktails that using unexpected ingredients. I found things like black walnut bitters and Mexican Coca-Cola and even smoked maple syrup.
Smoked maple
and, of
syrup
course, and Barton G. is ahead of the curve. Barton, I hear you have a lobster Bloody Mary with real lobster in it?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what else does it have? Bloody Mary mix, I suppose.
It's got, no, it's all made from scratch. And there's, and the ice cubes are infused vodka. There's Worcestershire, there's red hot sauce, there's chili pepper.
So, you know, I saw those ice cubes online. They're really attractive. That's very cool.
Yeah, definitely.
And you have a calamari tequila with squid tentacles sticking out of it. Now, that's bold. But in most cases here, I'm a wine guy, so even when it comes to cocktails, I like to base them on wine. And things like the normal champagne with orange juice for a mimosa and all that.
Right.
And in fact, when I go to the West Coast for wine judging competitions, we have something kind of like yours, Barton. We have a favorite cocktail that's a wine shooter, a nice fat oyster plunked into a glass of Sauvignon Blanc. And that's quite simple, but it's really pretty good.
Wow.
Now, but of course, I'm trying to get ahead of the curve as well now, so I've been Googling some new wine cocktails, and there are some really creative ones. The Cosmopolitan Magazine wine website lists the one called Just Keep Swimming, which is Sauvignon Blanc, vodka, watermelon juice, sugar, lemon juice, and soda water. And you shake them well over ice and make them nice and crisp and cold. Or you could make one called a goodnight kiss with champagne, a sugar cube, and two kinds of bitters. I guess that's kind of a bittersweet embrace. Or finally, if you want to be oh so correct, you can make one of Martha Stewart's favorite wine cocktails. It joins the hot trend of putting herbs in cocktails with the equally hot trend of drinking the sweet Italian white wine called Moscato. And in this one, you shake over ice the following ingredients: dried cranberries, organic pear nectar, sweet white Moscato wine, and 8 sprigs of rosemary. Sounds good, but I think the only problem is that since Martha is involved, you probably have to dry the cranberries and grow the pears yourself.
Well, thank you, Fred Tasker. Barton G., earlier on, you mentioned that about inspiration. So how do you get your inspiration?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's a good question.
That's an honest answer.
There's days when I feel creative, and there's days when I'm not. And my inspiration comes from anything from a screw and a nail to a goose. I mean, that's how varied it is. And when I see them in, whether it's their environments or I'm reading something about, you know, a fantasy character, it just inspires me to want to do more and want to do something that will be memorable and that I will be known for it. Because I don't like trying to take somebody else's recipes or ideas and converting them to mine. Go ahead.
You know, I was going to say, what's it like in your test kitchens there? You must all be having so much fun.
They do, and every day it's another, you know, it's another direction, and it's very, very hard for me to make up my mind. That's the hardest part of my job.
There's so many wonderful things. Bonnie, is there an email?
We have an emailer. It's indirectly, you know, kind of related, just to the unexpected. Kathleen says, people react surprisingly well. My last dinner party was a pajama party, and for invitations, I sent pajamagrams with a note saying that actually wearing the pajamas was optional. Every single guest arrived wearing the pajamas I sent, and the party was probably my most successful dinner party ever.
One wonders. So, Barton G., you're opening a restaurant in Los Angeles right now. You have Barton G., the restaurant here, but you've also back at the villa, the Versace Mansion. Tell us about that.
Well, the Versace Mansion, we're the management company, and we're the restaurant.
So you're managing the entire mansion now because it's a hotel now, is it?
It's a hotel, but I'm really just handling the food and beverage side of it in for the mansion.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the mansion is being run by the Nakash family.
So, and I mean, the room there is just absolutely gorgeous. Of course, it's been the same room with all of the tiles and the gold and the and all of that. But I was interested to find that you're keeping it in a modest level, the price range.
And that was something that after 3-4 years of being at the mansion and running the entire facility, I thought that this would be a great relief so that they could get a view of the mansion and get a reasonably priced dinner.
Well, it's a fun thing. I'm sure it's full all the time now.
It is. It's busy.
I like your chicken wings. That's kind of a novel thing. Tell us about those, Spartan.
Chicken wings turned inside out?
No, they're a dessert.
Oh.
Bonnie, you're back to desserts now.
We're back to desserts.
Chicken wings. There's so many chicken wings. It's made with, I think it's a cake. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, it's made with a cake. Tell them what's on it.
Well, it's a dessert. They're wing-shaped fried dough fritters.
Right.
Like the funnel cakes we would find at the fair, tossed in a honey orange marmalade wing sauce and served with a ranch mint and chocolate flecked whipped cream and paired with celery stalks.
Gee, I had that for breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
But go ahead, Barton. Go ahead.
No, and some of these things are to get a laugh, but the real part of it is if you really sat there and looked at it and extracted some of those ingredients, it's a really fun idea if you're having a barbecue and your dessert were these honey wings.
Right.
It's fun. I noticed your cake, your cheese board is really cheesecakes.
Right.
So the whole thing is just this big surprise when you bite into something or when you serve something. I think it makes a party a lot of fun, makes eating a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And you, in order to do or be interested in what I do, you have to have a passion for food and a passion for fun. Mix the two together, and that's the result.
Well, it certainly is. And on that note, Barton G., thank you so much for joining us. I know you're so busy out there opening up your restaurant.
Well, thank you.
It's been really, really interesting. His book is The Big Dish, Recipes to Dazzle and Amaze. It's truly an amazing book, and just go ahead and look at it, buy it, and you'll get ideas from it. You'll get inspiration. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Bonnie Berman, great to be with you.
Yes, and you and Fred and Barton, thank you.
Next week will be our annual Mango Madness program with Fairchild Director of Horticulture, Richard Campbell, and the Curator of Tropical Fruit, Norris Ledesma. It's going to be their mango festival coming up very soon.
I just have to say, I was at a friend's house recently, and I kept hearing these thuds on the roof in her room, off her living room. It was mangoes falling. I mean, by the...
I hear it's been an amazing year
for
mangoes. So I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that is Topical Currents for today. We thank you so much for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents, and you can follow me on Twitter at Bonnie Berman. And you can follow Linda on Twitter at L. Gassenheimer. Tomorrow at this time, please join Ed Bell for another edition of South Florida Arts Beat. June is Gay Pride Month and brings LGBT issues to the forefront. We return on Monday and explore the complex issues involved in estate planning for LGBT couples. Bonnie Berman joining you and sending our best wishes to Joseph Cooper and hoping your day and weekend are very, very good. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.